This is Fresh Air. There are hundreds of small airfields that dot the countryside all across America. Many have been carved out of farmland and are hangouts for pilots and high-flying adventurers. These small mom-and-pop operations are in danger of becoming obsolete, pushed out by sprawling commercial airports, suburban development, and the high cost of owning and maintaining a small private plane. Writer and flyer Lawrence Gonzalez wanted to capture that life before it was gone. His new book, 10 Charlie, is about one small airstrip in northern Illinois. It's also about the eccentric characters and adventurers who are drawn to flying, as well as his own attraction to the dangers and his passion for the thrill. I asked Gonzalez to read an excerpt from the book about the impulse to fly.
I do not mean to say that anyone who learns to fly an airplane is an addict. For many people, it is merely a pastime or a profession, and an airplane is simply a tool, like a halberd or a hypodermic needle. But there are those of us who fly, I mean who really fly a lot and with a mad, insatiable passion and all the time thinking and dreaming of it, with that tingling in our fingers and toes, yearning for the feel of the stick and rudder, and with a deep socket in our bellies that can only be filled by G-force and swirling mists. And I believe that we perform our feats of daring in the service of altered brain chemistry. It is precisely this impulse that has been the cornerstone of aviation since the very beginning. Why else would someone throw himself off a cliff with a pair of homemade wings strapped to his back while the certainty of death and the hope of flight struggle for dominion over his leaping heart? The impulse, a mystical disease of the mind which overwhelms our will and propels us against all good sense not simply into flight, but into more and more dangerous and audacious methods of rocketeering, controlled falling, death leaps, and fiery plummets to earth. The impulse, it's the only explanation.
Did you feel that impulse the first time you flew?
Absolutely. I did. It was, and many, many people have described the same thing to me. The old man who started the airfield about which this book is written, Art Gault, who is now, I think, 82, he went out there to be a farmer, and one day he happened to get a ride in an airplane, and it was all over for him. It was the end. He had to go and learn to fly, and in fact, his whole life became aviation, and he now owns an airport. And it happens that way over and over again. Some people are immune to it, but for some people, it simply takes over in a way that is like nothing else except an addiction.
Well, you describe it as an experience of altered brain chemistry, almost as if it's a fever.
I think so. There's a section in this book in which we describe the aerobatic pilots I fly with. We go up and we do things that look like dangerous things to other people, but we consider that it's safe enough if we follow the rules. And one of the rules is you don't roll the airplane on takeoff. It's too low. It's too dangerous. So there's always somebody saying, now remember, no low-level aerobatics. Don't roll on takeoff. And the next thing you know, you turn around and a guy's doing it. He's like rolling the airplane on takeoff, and you say, why did you do that? And he can't explain. It's like, I don't know. I was just taking off, and it just felt right, and I thought, God, you know, this is great. I'm going to roll. And, well, people get killed doing that all the time. Why do we do that?
But is there something about bending the laws of nature, bending the rules, that somehow when you get close to that, you think, well, I'll just take one more little step?
Well, I think there is, but I think there is also literally a kind of it's like a downhill skier needs to go down the slope. What does he get out of the slope? He doesn't go anywhere. When he's at the end, he's just at the bottom where he started. What's in between? I think what's in between is a great mystery, and most people who are interesting are following some sort of mystery in their lives. And for those of us who are captured by flying, we go up, the world drops away, and there's this kind of celestial spider out there weaving this web that we're caught in, and that is our mystery. We're going toward it all the time. We never get there. We never find out what it is.
What is it, though, about flying that makes people so philosophical? And I would say almost everyone I've interviewed about flying and being a pilot, they always have these philosophical thoughts.
Yes. Well, think about it. I mean, let's suppose that you're an adventurer and you decide you're going to go into the Congo and experience this amazing wilderness that no other human being has ever been in. And you go out there and you stay for a year and you come back and you've had a lot of time to get in touch with yourself and think about things and sort of pursue the inner course of your spirit and life. And what we have that like in our backyards. We drive to the airport 15 minutes away, jump in the plane, the earth drops away, and we're in this alien environment where we can meet ourselves. No one up there can bring us back. It's all our own skill. We're completely dependent on ourselves. We might as well be in the deepest, darkest jungle because nothing's going to bring us back except our own ability. And out there, all alone like that, with all of the stuff of the earth having fallen away from us, we're not thinking about our MasterCard bill. We're not thinking about Clinton's proposals. We're just out there completely alone with the sky. And it's not even a sky we recognize because we're in the middle of it. So it's all of this faint, misty stuff. And of course, we're going to start thinking about spiritual and philosophical things up there.
When you're flying, are you consciously aware of death?
Well, not every moment. I mean, you do get used to flying, and it can be dangerous in some ways to become complacent. But yes, there are always things happening around you that make you used to it. I mean, the smell of gasoline will really, really get your attention in an airplane because you will know someone who has been incinerated. Or if you see an airplane go by close to you, it'll get your attention because you know someone who's died in a midair collision. Because of the fact that many of your friends have already died, it's in the back of your mind, if not in the front of your mind.
Well, I want to talk about aerial acrobatics, which you got into, but first I want to take a very short break. My guest today is Lawrence Gonzalez, and we're talking about a book he's just written called 10 Charlie, Adventures in Grassroots Aviation. It's about the world of amateur aviation, and my guest is both a writer and a pilot. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Lawrence Gonzalez, and he's written a book called 10 Charlie. That's the name for a private airfield, which is located in northern Illinois. It's a Galt airport. Now, let's talk about your foray into aerial acrobatics. What made you think that you were going to take then the next step? Why wasn't just flying enough for you?
Well, it's interesting because when I first flew, I was so scared that I thought just getting from one airport to another and landing safely was a great accomplishment, and I would want to rush back and tell all my friends about it. But I went out. My father was receiving this decoration at Randolph Air Force Base for Air Force flying he had done, and I was out there with all these jets screaming around overhead, and I just had to get up in one, and I finally managed to get a ride, and this fellow let me do loops and rolls and all these other things, and I just realized how tremendously important it was that I get an aerobatic airplane and learn to do that myself.
Now, what's the first thing that you learn?
Well,
where do you start?
It depends on who your instructor is, but my aerobatics instructor, John Morrissey, believes that to teach the roll is the correct way to begin teaching aerobatics because it's probably the hardest thing to do. It looks very simple.
And the roll is, just describe for us.
The roll is one wing goes down, the other wing goes up, and you just keep going around until you're back right side up. It is the basis of so many other maneuvers that the feeling is that if you can learn to do that right, you have a firm foundation. It's like learning scales in music before you learn to play arias.
And how was it for you to do your first roll then?
Well, it was horrible. First of all, you find that as soon as you tip the airplane over, it starts to fall out of the sky, so you have to correct for that. And when you get to about the knife edge where your wing is pointing straight down at the ground, why, everything goes completely haywire. And as you go upside down, the controls seem to reverse, so you put the stick one way and it wants to go the other way. It's just totally confusing. And you have to sort of get in your mind a picture of where all these little pieces of the airplane are pointing into the airstream. And of course, while you're doing this, your head is banging against the side of the canopy and you're being pulled and you're hanging by your seatbelt when you're upside down. And it's all disconcerting. the blue part that we call the sky is now on the bottom, and the green part is on the top. It's just a total mess.
I've noticed in looking through some of the other things that you've written that you do seem to have an interest in danger. You've done essays on, or you did an essay on the death chamber and prisoners put to death and jails and things like that.
I would say the death chamber has a very high mortality rate.
It's very
dangerous place to be statistically. I have a new book that I've been working on for several years that's it's not out yet. It's a collection of essays about people who have dangerous professions. And I've worked as a fireman, and I've worked on top of tall construction sites and out on an oil rig in the Gulf of Mexico, which was probably the scariest place I've ever been.
What made working on an oil rig in the Gulf of Mexico so difficult?
Well, it's kind of like being in a Cuisinart when the blades start turning. The oil rig is this platform that stands about 16 stories out of the sea, and on top of it, there's this naked skeleton of steel, and there are all these moving parts. They're constantly in motion all over the deck. And so it's kind of like being in some machine that's designed to slice things up, and you're one of the things, and you just have to get out of the way. And not only that, but the fellows that I was working with there, these were not like the firemen who I think would have saved my life if anything bad had happened to me. These were guys who were looking at me like, it might be fun to see a reporter get crushed.
Well, did they try to put you in harm's way just to teach you a lesson?
There was one moment that I describe in this essay where I was standing there watching a guy put together a piece of drilling equipment, and I all of a sudden noticed that about five people were looking at me, and they were kind of like looking just a little past me. And I thought, what are they looking at? I'm just standing here taking notes. And I turned around just in time to see this beam. It was about 30 feet long, and it was being moved by a crane, and it was coming right for me. And I just kind of stepped aside, and it went by, and they all kind of shrugged. Well, I guess it missed him this time.
But you don't think they would have told you at the last minute?
It didn't look like it for me. A lot of them also, it was an interesting crew. It was kind of like being on a pirate ship. Some of these guys had missing fingers and missing hands and missing eyes. And, you know, they all had a story to tell. So
are there, do you enjoy the mundane things of life as well?
Of course. but what's mundane in life? Nothing
is
mundane.
I don't know. I mean,
what could be mundane? All I thought when I went out to do this book about Galt Airport is a very quiet, sleepy little place, you know. And I thought, this will be a nice, relaxing place to be for a while. I think I'll just stay here and sort of, you know, with these quiet little people around me and find out what their lives are like. I had no idea it was going to turn into this amazing adventure.
Well, can you say the same thing for the work that you did in Hollywood? And you once wrote for TV shows, one called Codename Foxfire.
Right.
Did you have that same experience out there?
Well, I went out to work for Universal and then for Warner Brothers in serial television. You know, whatever you see when you turn on the TV at 7 o'clock, that's the kind of stuff we were doing, which I thought was really, really awful. But the people who did it were so fascinating. They were just not to be believed. And they were so outrageous that I used to sit in these meetings and just take down what they said because I thought, nobody's going to believe this guy said this.
Well, what's an example of an unbelievable interchange?
Well, geez. I mean, they used to talk about, I can't even repeat it on the radio. They used to talk about the star, Kate Jackson, who was the star of this one show we worked on called Scarecrow and Mrs. King, in ways that were just unrepeatable. And all day long, I mean, she was supposed to be this, like, idol that the audience loved her. But the people who wrote her lines just despised her, and for good reason, because she would take the scripts and send them back at 11 o'clock at night and demand that they be rewritten. There was one scene where there was a duck in a pond in this scene, and she demanded that the duck be removed because she hated ducks. So we all had to stay up till midnight writing this duck out of the script.
Well, I thank you very much. It's really been fun to talk with you, and I thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Lawrence Gonzalez is a flyer and a writer. His book is called 10 Charlie. This is Fresh Air.